Welcome back to Shrinking It Down, Mental Health Made Simple. I'm Gene Bresson.
And I am Khadija Booth Watkins.
Oh, today. Our country, since its inception, has been founded on racism. And as we've seen highlighted recently, it's really a misnomer that our core is every person is created equal, and this is the land of the free. We've seen this most recently in numerous disparities, people of color, economic access to care and housing, police brutality, and much more. Joe Betancourt has devoted his career to understanding, conducting research, and trying to dispel many of these disparities here at MGH. And I'd like to quote his own words. I always like to quote other people's words. I was born in New York City to a bilingual household, then raised in New York City and Puerto Rico. My family and these experiences had led me to a life focused on equity and social justice and fueled my pursuit of diversity and equity in healthcare. I founded the Disparity Solutions Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, and now I'm Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer. I also co-founded Quality Interactions, an innovative e-learning company focused on cross-cultural communication in healthcare. Now, I've had the privilege of knowing Joe for, over 20 years. And among his work, he's associate professor at Harvard Medical School. And let's just mention a couple other things as background. He's been for currently and for 19 years senior scientist at the MGH Mangan Institute. And the major focus for this institute consists of research aimed at identifying and addressing disparities in healthcare. So it's uniquely positioned to leverage the extraordinary research environment of MGH, as well as national and international collaborators, to solve most of the intractable challenges in healthcare. He's also, for 21 years, been co-founder and president of Quality Interactions. And Quality Interactions was founded by Joe, along with Alex Green, MD, MPH, and Emilio Carrillo, to improve cross-cultural interactions in healthcare. Their cultural competency courses for healthcare, developed by practicing physicians, build critical communication skills and change attitudes and behavior by tracking complex issues like unconscious bias. And to date, Quality Interactions has trained over 250,000 healthcare professionals at the country's largest hospitals, health plans, and medical schools. Now, I know I've just said a lot, but just to make life a little more fun, how's the week been? Joe.
Great question. Well, thank you. First of all, Gene and Khadija, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be a part of this and really, thrilled to get a chance to have this conversation. How's the week been? We're early in the week, but, continues to be a time, in our society, so much transformation and, politically, certainly around the work that I care deeply about. So I think this week has been like a lot of other weeks, kind of a blur, but, very gratifying in that I feel like we're moving forward on a lot of different areas that are near and dear to my heart, including, on the societal level, certainly, but also, at our hospital and across our system. So that's the way I'd sum up this past week. And every day that we're making, that I feel like we're making progress is a good day.
How about you, Khadija?
This week has been refreshing. Last week was incredibly busy, but this week has started off being pretty refreshing. I created my menu for the holiday and made my plans to try to make the holiday, as normal-ish as possible, since we're not traveling to visit with family, which is going to be big because we have a big family and we usually are used to all being together. So just being thoughtful and creative about how we will do it this year to make it, as special and as normal-like as possible. How about you?
Well, it's week two of my puppy. So fortunately, she's been sleeping. It's kind of like having a baby. She's been sleeping. Last night, she slept like 7 hours, which was like amazing. So that's been a real joy. As well as a, challenge. The other thing for me, we've had a couple interviews with major media outlets, and they've been challenging because they're asking questions about how are we going to cope with this long, dark winter, you know, particularly with COVID potentially surging after Thanksgiving. And how do we motivate our kids, and how do we work with our kids, and how do we keep everybody on track? You know, lots of folks are depressed, and rightfully so. So I think it's been stressful and challenging for me to kind of keep things on the positive and hopeful side. And Joe, I'm so glad you began that way, because I think if we don't keep the hope and the faith, we're not going to accomplish very much. So anyway, let's get on with our questions. So Joe, you know, your background and current position affords you the ability to use years and years of research and educational programming to promote social justice, inclusion, and battle disparities. But you're beginning a new effort at MGH, hopefully will extend to the Mass General Brigham. Can you tell us a little bit about what your planning is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and thank you. I think, you know, the work that I do, I care deeply about, and, you know, I'm very passionate about. And I think I assume this position at Mass General, you know, providing formal oversight of our diversity, equity, and inclusion, my gosh, in May of last year, with the idea that we would try to, you know, fundamentally intersect this important work with the four pillars of our mission: care, training, research, and community health. And, you know, that work was moving, you know, forward quite nicely when COVID hit, and you know, we took great pains to try to respond in an equitable way and with a kind of what I would say is a kind of doorstep to bedside approach to meeting the needs of diverse populations. And I think undoubtedly saw the disproportionate impact of COVID on communities of color, came out of that. And then, you know, as you articulated when you began, the murder of George Floyd, you know, one of a series over not decades, but, you know, centuries of violence against Black men, women, and children, you know, brought this issue to I think, the forefront and created a national reckoning, Gene, for me in ways that I think I viewed as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to leverage people's, I think, sense of moral injury to create some, you know, I'll use this analogy, really, to grab as much land by building as much, many new structures and resources and accountability to address the issue of structural racism, you know, in and outside our worlds, and racism more generally. And we've done that in two particular ways. At the system side, Mass General Brigham worked diligently to create an effort called United Against Racism, which focuses on, you know, our people, our culture, our clinical care, our community health, even how we use our resources and how we invest in our community and in diversity. And then, you know, kind of complementary to that, we built something called the MGH Structural Equity 10-Point Plan, which is quite comprehensive and aims to do all types of things to really, you know, kind of, again, focus on people, culture, and care, and in unprecedented ways, commit resources and accountabilities and what I would say is the execution of rigor, which quite frankly has lacked for a lot of years in this work, a lot of aspiration, probably not as much focus on rigor and execution. Those two efforts, I think, are incredibly exciting. And I say unprecedented because never in my lifetime have we had an opportunity, I think, to get the amount of resources and the structures and this kind of plan landed the way we did in the last, you know, several months.
So I guess my thought is to address these issues around structural racism and inequity, it's going to take a team of various people from various backgrounds, a pretty diverse group. But I also would imagine critical to the effort would be having faculty and staff of color. And so I guess my question would be around the issue of recruitment and retention of faculty and staff of color. That's probably going to be somewhat of a challenge because I don't think Boston is a place that's high on most people's lists of people of color to move to. It definitely wasn't on my list of places to go. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are around increasing recruitment and retention of faculty and staff of color to help in this mission of really addressing the issues.
And I say that that's what we'd affectionately refer to as point seven, initiative seven of the 10-point plan, which is our effort to increase diversity and equal representation in governance and leadership and across the institution. So I'd say a couple things. There's no doubt that I think, around the country, there's been a lot of talk of diversity for a long time, including, at MGH. And I've been part of it. I've been here, as you mentioned, for almost 20 years and I've been part of our Center for Diversity and Inclusion. So what have we seen? I think we've seen progress. I think it's been a drip, drip, drip progress. It's not the progress that any of us would like. It's a complex issue. But that being said, I absolutely believe we can and should and will do more. And that requires several key components to it. It isn't just if you build it, they will come, right? You need to think about this in multiple ways. First, you need to have resources to make sure that people that we attract and people that we're aiming to retain feel like they are valued and they can, kind of go about their lives. The communities of individuals who we're trying to recruit have larger, debt burden. Boston's not a cheap place. So those resources are critical, I think, in kind of leveraging that, it's not just we want you here, but we're going to make this an opportunity that's livable for you. I'd say number two, another key point here is that it's not just come and join and we check a box. How are we going to recruit while we also retain, promote, support, develop, create an environment where you feel included and you can grow? And just recruiting you into a standard slot, in my view, is not good enough. We need to have a part of an approach as we bring people on to say, how are we going to help you get to your trajectory? How are we going to support that with resources, programs, and have a vision for you? I'd also say that, people want to come to a place where they see other people who look like them on their care team and also see patients who look like them. And I think we have an opportunity to do even more around increasing the diversity of our patients with this chicken and egg idea that, if you're trying to recruit somebody who's diverse, they want to, likely care for a diverse patient population. You can't do one without the other. And so I think that's a key part of what we aim to accomplish. And accountability is essential here. So, I think our leaders really respond to accountability goals and targets. And, for all too long, I felt like we haven't been courageous enough to set goals and targets around diversity. And we should. And why shouldn't we? This is not about making exceptions or lowering standards. This is about recruiting top talent to a top institution. And part of the thing I'll end with is that, there's Boston, there's Cleveland, there's a bunch of differences, Rochester, where Mayo is. I mean, there's a bunch of places. No place is great. I don't think, we're better than some and maybe worse than others. But this is a chance, in my view, and the way we're pitching this is come join a movement, come be part of something special. We're also not some small little regional hospital. We are Mass General and we take pride in that. And I think if we are to truly live out our values and vision, we do have to have a care team that reflects our communities.
I liked your notion of accountability and demonstrating efficacy. So we had a recent podcast with O'Neill Britton, and he pointed out that we all have implicit bias, no matter one's race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation. So one very valuable tool that does have a long history, over 50 years, I guess, is the implicit association test. And I wonder whether or not it's come to your, come up that we should all be taking the IAT, fairly routinely and kind of monitoring our implicit biases and learning from them.
Yeah. No, Gina, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think, look, the science on this has evolved. I think, in 1999, when I was part of the Institute of Medicine Report on Equal Treatment, we surveyed doctors around, bias in clinical decision-making. 99% said, no, not me, right? The not me phenomenon is very powerful because, we as caregivers think we have blinders on. We're taught that we have blinders on to personal characteristics and we're making decisions with these blinders that are equitable and just. And that's just not a fact. It's just not the fact because we're human, right? And we're susceptible to those same, stereotypes. The good news is in 2016, the last big survey that was done, 16,000 doctors surveyed, 43% now agreeing that they have biases that impact their clinical decision-making. The ability for us to advance the science of this discussion and move away from good or bad people to all human beings who are susceptible to taking untoward actions, particularly on things they see with their eyes, race, gender, and age, stereotypes activated the most in cases where we're stressed, under time constraints, and multitasking. You know, all that has allowed us, I think, to bring a lot more awareness to this. I'd end here by saying that awareness is nice. We could train people about implicit bias, and I think that that's helpful. At the end of the day, the real kind of pivot is accountability and measurement. So, okay, we've done this training. What are you going to do differently in the decisions you make and in the responsibilities you have that are going to take that into account? And how can we measure that so we could then tell you if you've lived up to those promises? Because I'm a big believer in training, but I'm not a big believer in training as a check the box tool. We need to have training as part of a biosphere, a portfolio of activities that are going to lead to measurable change. And I think whether it be bystander, microaggressions, implicit bias and stereotyping, racism, you know, cross-cultural communication, all those things need to be part of a mandated learning portfolio that addresses the needs of different learners in different disciplines, but is an essential part of our fabric.
So Joe, one really important question is, implicit bias is pervasive, but how does it actually affect the provision of healthcare as you've seen it over time?
Yeah, Gene, the evidence is crystal clear. I mean, going back 20 years when we started doing this work, and again, referring back to the Institute of Medicine and Unequal Treatment, you know, we were asked by Congress of the Institute of Medicine, do doctors treat people differently? And we explored this and we said, you know, the racism exists, healthcare, like many aspects of society is, you know, built on structural racism. And so there's no reason to believe that people are making deliberate choices, although we hope not. And it wasn't tested back then, like it was tested with paired testers for mortgage lending, housing, you know, criminal justice and education, where you kind of could see these patterns. That being said, you know, we delved deeply into this concept of stereotyping and began to connect this idea that, assumptions that you might make of people will then and frequently do impact your care decisions and the way you communicate with people. So, we began to talk about that. And there were several examples, like a study that showed that African-Americans compared to whites with end-stage renal disease on hemodialysis were less likely to be referred for renal transplantation than their white counterparts. And it wasn't because they didn't want to be on the list. And then when you do an analysis of that, you see that there's a big chunk of that decision-making that is subjective. And when something is subjective, it is subject to a person's thought processes, both conscious and unconscious, right? And so that was our working hypothesis. So to cut to the chase, you know, there have been many studies since that time where have used the implicit association test to measure subconscious biases and then given individuals case studies to measure their clinical decision-making. And as you might imagine, individuals who had higher levels of subconscious, you know, biases also were more likely to make care decisions that led to disparities. So this is, you know, this isn't conjecture. This isn't like, oh, it's a nice thing for us to know if we have stereotypes. In the clinical setting, I would argue it's almost lethal, because you have a population who believes that they're not affected by it, who is affected by it, that then impacts their care decisions in ways that they don't know, believe, or understand and don't think happen. So it is the perfect storm for disparities. It's not the only cause of disparities, but is one that really requires education and continued exploration.
And let me just follow up just briefly. There's good reason for people of color not to trust the healthcare system. I won't go into the history. We all can look it up. It's there. Are you planning on taking a look at how things change in terms of the perception of the folks that come to the Mass General and the way they're treated and the way they're provided their health care?
Yeah. So, Gene, you know, the good news here is that we have done a lot of this work over the years. The challenge with it is it hasn't been powered and resourced enough to bring it to scale. But I'll give you one example. You know, in the early 2000s, when we began to stratify our patient experience by race ethnicity, You know, we saw two things. Number one, that not all voices were at the table, meaning the response rates of individuals who come get care with us were lower among people of color. And number two, what we decided to do, and I guess what we thought was really important, is how do we go about hearing those voices? And so in 2004, we did a survey where we oversampled minority patients to get a sense of their experience with us. And I'll just give you one data point. In 2004, 25% of Latinos, 21% of African Americans, felt like white patients next to them at MGH got better care than they did. In from 2004 to 2012, we spent 5 years doing trainings, building a lot of the structures around equity and, you know, all these things. And in 2012, we surveyed again, and those numbers dropped from 25% to 9% among Latinos and from 21% to 6% among among African Americans. And they went down to single digits in 2017. So two lessons here. You can't manage what you don't measure. To your point, you need to really get a sense of people's experience and maybe go above and beyond just the standard tools. And number two, you know, when you find something, you do something. We found big differences. We developed interventions. And I think we're proud to say that we saw improvements. We need to bring those to scale. And so the answers are resounding yes.
Yeah, that's awesome, because I think it is one of these things that we know and we see, but there's very little in terms of scales and out to measure outcomes to really be able to point to what the biases are, what the perceptions are, so that you can actually directly address them to give patients a better experience and to make them feel better cared for. I just want to go back to the implicit bias test. So if we were to incorporate that into training, do you have any thoughts on the best way to administer it and the best way to really address the results? So in terms of just processing the results, yeah. Because like you said, we all feel like, you know, to some degree we're physicians, we don't have any bias, we're all good. So I think really the processing of the outcome is going to be really important. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, Jean and I, when we first intersected, was at our work at Harvard Medical School and doing stuff in that area around cross-cultural communication. And I remember, just as an example, that, you know, in the mid-2000s, we had a requirement that any Harvard medical student, when they began as part of their orientation, they need to read Unequal Treatment, they need to read The Spirit Catches You Fall Down, and then they needed to take the implicit association test. And then during orientation, and, you know, when they first arrived, we would do a debrief of this, right? And I'll tell you, you know, focusing on the IAT, what you learn is that, you know, the not me phenomenon is very, very powerful. These are smart people, and, you know, the first three things out of their mouths are, I don't believe this test. Has this been validated? Are these questions legit? Like, you know, because you're so uncomfortable with what you've seen that it just can't be real. It's the conscious versus the subconscious, right? And so that was a big lesson for us, because what we understood is just administering the IAT and saying, okay, good luck, that's not good enough. And just administering the IAT and then doing a breakout group and not having a facilitator who was trained to manage that response was also perilous. So I would say that the IAT is very important, but it needs to be built in a kind of a thoughtful learning pathway that allows for, you know, an orientation to what the test is, taking the test, I think a good facilitated discussion, and addresses, you know, those stages of grief, if you will, right, that people have after they do the IAT, that says, look, this isn't about good or bad people. It's about a normal mind and your awareness of how your mind is working. And let's think about ways in which you can counteract that. So those are some of the biggest lessons we had doing that, you know, and doing it over the years, because this is something that we see all the time. People assume a very defensive posture when they do the IAT, and you need to be able to manage that well.
I just have another question then. So this is really hard, emotionally draining work. How do we fight fatigue and demoralization and just the seeing the efforts wane over time? I was really worried with COVID that things would kind of peter out because people are already so exhausted from so many other things. That's going to be really important to manage. And I'm just worried about the toll that it's taken on people.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that if you care deeply about this work and you see this opportunity, you're trying to work 24/7 to try to, you know, again, grab as much land as you can, because you know that the window at this level of engagement will close, and you have to be careful not to do it at your own peril, you know, and make sure you have balance make sure that you, you know, kind of just, I don't believe in tempering my expectations, but to some degree for your own kind of mental health and well-being, you need to temper your expectations, understanding these things weren't built overnight. They're not going to be fixed overnight. My generation, you know, each generation will contribute to that, you know, to the vector of bending, you know, the moral arc of the universe towards justice. And I think part of what you do as you live through this is you try to kind of bend that arc as much as you can with all your might, but you understand that, you know, I got to be proud that if I can contribute one or two pretty strong vectors to that and then pass it on, you know, and certainly I think all of us are not effective if we're burnt out and we're not able to give it our best. So it is a challenging time, and it's been a challenging year in so many ways with, you know, with all this work, and to think that now at year's end we're gearing up again is, you know, it's really daunting.
So what other question? I imagine that your the curriculum, the training, has to not just include healthcare professionals and allied healthcare professionals, but virtually everybody who's at Mass General, from the security guards to the valet parkers to you name it, to anybody that folks come in contact with, to create a whole culture across disciplines and across the spectrum. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's absolutely fair to say. And I think, you know, the there's that need, and there's also the challenge of executing that, right? Because that's not one course for everybody. I mean, you need to really understand that we need to have a series of, you know, kind of key principles and messages that we deliver through a variety of learning modalities that are respectful of the learner, the time they have, their level of, you know, kind of, you know, computer literacy, general literacy around all these things. So, you know, unlike developing a course for a particular discipline that you know, you have a set of common characteristics that unify a group, you know, when you think about training 26,000 people, what we're thinking about is, in fact, a bucket of, you know, 5 to 7 offerings, of which you'll have to, from a mandatory standpoint, do at least one, but they will be some that allow people to go deep if they want to. And there will be others that won't be reductionist, but will be give you the basic skills that you need. And, you know, across that portfolio, we believe that we can start to speak the same language, advance that culture of, you know, inclusion and equity and move forward. It, you know, it's definitely going to take some time, but that's the thought process that we're bringing into this work.
And one other thing that's kind of related to that is, you know, it seems that to me that there's more than just teaching folks about their own racism or just, you know, implicit biases. And that is kind of changing the way we present ourselves to patients. In other words, are we going to have, you know, monitors that are in different languages? Are we going to have posters on the walls? Are we going to have, you know, open displays of welcoming people of different color? Are we going to, you know, McLean did a wonderful job of destigmatizing psychiatric disorders, mental illness in Logan Airport. And I remember kind of walking down the hallway and seeing
this.
It's amazing. It made me feel so, well, proud of McLean, but also it was a message. And are we going to be creating those messages visually and in other ways other than through education?
Yes, without question. That would be a point nine, initiative nine, and I'm embarrassed to say that I have them memorized by now. That is our inclusion campaign, yes. And we're thinking about physical space, you know, democratizing communication so that, you know, all of our employees, all, you know, we get all our stuff via Zoom and email, right? All our updates. Like, there's whole parts of our organization that's the most diverse that don't have access to that. Absolutely. I mean, so, you know, our point nine is really focused on all those things, which is how do we really create a welcoming environment in our physical space with our events, you know, this idea of inclusion and making people valued. We are going to be way more deliberate about that. And it's going to be resourced in ways that it's never been resourced before. So, you know, a lot of these things, you know, over the years have been done at the margin, done, you know, after hours, done on weekends, you know, any of these efforts by passionate people. I think we turn the corner now and say that this is an opportunity to really institutionalize this. And I think we've we've put those, we've planted those seeds now and are watering them well. So that's, you know, the reason it's a 10-point plan is because it's comprehensive. And when we started to roll out, people said, maybe you should do three, maybe you should be four. I was like, three or four are not going to fix the problem. 10's not going to fix the problem. But 10's better than three or four. And I think the 10 that we chose are fairly comprehensive. And I think they will address a lot of the things that we care about.
Resourcing is just so important, because in thinking about, again, going back to keeping the momentum and keeping people engaged, you have a group of passionate people doing the work, and it's exhausting when it's just a small group doing all of the work, and really to be able to kind of spread it out to have, you know, more of a team that is resourced and there to do that work, as opposed to, like you said, squeezing it in on the weekends and after hours, it's going to be a much better outcome.
Yeah, and we built that in, and I'm very wary of the, you know, what we call the minority tax or the black tax, where we have a problem and we ask the people who suffer from the problem to fix it, and we ask them to fix it through committees and volunteer activities. That's not transformation. That's not really kind of funding your values and I think what we've done now is a huge pivot there. We are, you know, we've all been on committees that kind of just kind of grind on, and you kind of got one or two people who do all the work, and then, you know, eventually you just stop going because you're like, oh, nothing ever happens here. Or just, you know, they got it. You know, we really want to create robust committees that allow people to provide their input, and then a team to execute that on that input with resources and with the plan, so that people feel like, wow, my time was really well spent there. People cared about how much time I spent. They were thoughtful about it, and they were good stewards of my time. And that's the environment we want to create. We want people to be recognized for the time they give by their departments and their divisions and their leaders. And, you know, I'm even playing with the idea of, like, can we give people incentives, gifts, or, you know, things like just to value their time that they're giving up for something else. Just these small things, I think, are small tokens of appreciation that we often don't receive when we have to do this work.
Well, we could go on. But Joe, I really, you know, want to emphasize how important the work you're doing it. Well, you're doing now, and all the work you've done to lay the groundwork for this. I mean, it's been amazing, and we're all going to chip in, and we'd love to have.
I just say, Gene, you know, this work, I could create a superstructure. We could create some of the big things, but, you know, if we're going to change this organization, it takes every single one of us to look around and say, what are the one, two, or three things I'm going to do differently? And for anybody who has, you know, in any leadership position, to say, what are the five things I'm going to do to change the, you know, the ways in which I provide oversight, guidance, management, goal setting, all that stuff. That is, that can't all be done by me. If we all commit to that, then, you know, and just at least communicate that with each other, so we're all kind of rowing to some degree in the same direction, that's what will make us a better place. And so I appreciate, you know, that perspective of it's going to take all of us.
For folks that want to kind of add some comments or make some suggestions or, you know, have Joe come back, please let us know what you'd like. But let's end as we typically do and talk about what struck you in the news this week. So, Khadija, what struck you in the news?
So I was reading going back to the holiday, I was reading the New York Times, and I saw the picture of the tree at Rockefeller Center looking all mangled and just so sad. And it just was like, this is 2020. And this is another example of just riding the struggle bus in 2020. But really, as we come to the end, just using that as an opportunity to think about, again, how can I turn this around? And what can I look back and say, you know, I was trapped at home and I didn't get to do some of the things I wanted to do, but this, in the end, I was able to do this, or I was able to accomplish that. Just going back to thinking about what I can be grateful for and how I could have made this year, as tough as it was, kind of have some purpose. But looking at the tree really just kind of made me stop in my tracks, because it was something I was looking forward to doing at some point before the end of the year, going to see the tree at the center. How about you, Jane?
You know, I'm a news addict, but I won't get political, although this will be political.
Not today.
No, well, I will be political a little bit. No, actually, I've, you know, as President-elect Biden has been rolling out his cabinet nominees, it's really apparent to me that he's not just going for experience, but he's going for diversity. And he wants, just as Joe was pointing out, we want Mass General and its staff to look like the folks that come in. I'm really encouraged that our government will look like America. And that's I think, what struck me positively in the news today. Joe, how about you?
Oh boy, so much in the news, you know, and I think I agree with you. I mean, I think there's this common sense of, you know, at least a change to just how we interact with each other and kind of this, you know, hope for more dignity and respect in how we treat each other as fellow human beings. I mean, I think that you see that in the news and different signs of this, you know, kind of, you know, I too sometimes say, you know, I don't want to get political, but, and I say that because I don't believe respect, dignity are political, you know, attributes that anyone can or should claim. I respect people's differing views around social or fiscal policy, but I think we need to get back to a place where civility and decency and dignity and respect become core tenets that we role model from the top. And I think, you know, just looking at the news and finally a sense of taking a deep breath and feeling like, wow, this turmoil looks like it might be coming to a close. It's just like it's opening up a you know, kind of a new window for promise. So that's kind of my news digest of the you know, several pieces that and how they made me feel.
Cool. Well, everybody, thank you so much, Joe, for being here. And again, folks listening, please, we want to hear your feedback. I'm Gene Bresson.
Bisha Booth Watkins.
As always, we hope that our conversation will help you have yours. And I'll see you next time.
And again, I think our biggest message to caregivers needs to be, you are human. Human beings are wired in such a way where this is a normal function, where it can help us in some ways develop clinical acumen, walking into a room, seeing something that before you even need any data, you can help you identify that person's starting to get sick, but it can betray you when it relates to the way you communicate and care for people, particularly around lines of race, gender, and age, where we those stereotypes are kind of most potent because they're the things we see with our eyes.